This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places and pints of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. In Inglewood, it is a celebration of collaboration and community with a black-owned craft beer business.
I'm Betty Ashburn, the CEO of Crowns & Hops Brewing Company with this guy right here.
Thank you all for coming out. We love you all. We see you all. We are so honored that you would come out during this reopening period. And with that said...
That's T.O. Hunter with Benny Ashburn, the co-owners of the craft beer maker, trying to build a new business here in Inglewood and do their part to protect the community's culture.
Fast forwarding to now, Benny and myself created Crowns & Hops Brewing Company. It'll be the first black-owned craft brewery in Inglewood. And one of less than 1% black-owned breweries in the entire country.
You heard that right. According to a report by the national trade group, the Brewers Association, fewer than 1% of 8,000 breweries nationwide are black-owned. Well, Benny and Tio are determined to change that with Crowns & Hops, opening up a community gathering spot right here in Inglewood. Now, this city is in the midst of a development boom with multiple housing projects planned, a light rail train line set to open next year, and the nation's newest and most expensive football stadium hosting the Super Bowl in February. Today, reporter Hawa Otori takes us to Inglewood, where one black-owned business is trying to build and preserve the city's black culture and lead the way in diversifying the niche industry of craft beer.
Benny Ashburn and Tio Hunter mingle with guests at picnic tables, drinking pints of their latest beer release called Crowns & Knots. They're in an outdoor event space, illuminated by the warm LA sun. They work at Crowns & Hops branded tent, outfitted with their company's merch, strike up conversations with guests, and accept selfie requests. There's no physical location for their brewery yet. Instead, they do pop-up events that have become their signature, marketed to black and brown communities, family-friendly, inclusive spaces. They leave you feeling like you spent good quality time with a couple of your closest friends and their friends. Events like this have helped them build a loyal, growing following for their company.
Our entire brand was built on the support of the community. So today, as the world starts to open back up, it's pretty amazing to see people put trust in us by even showing up. You know, people are getting vaccinated, people are still taking their COVID tests, but to know that people are willing to come out and show support, even in today's climate, is really amazing.
People like Aisha Dillard. She's local, charismatic, active on social media, and wasn't into craft beer until Crowns & Hops branding got her interested.
This is the first time meeting them in person, but we have such a connection through social media. They really have kind of captured how you make your audience feel special and feel seen. And that's what they've done for me.
And Benny and Tio were intentional about creating this type of atmosphere to welcome more black people into craft beer.
Like I'm a queen.
They've been concerned about the lack of diversity for years. Dr. J. Jackson Beckham, everyone calls her Dr. J, studies exactly that problem. She's the Brewer Association's equity and inclusion partner, and she says these aren't isolated problems.
The craft beverage industry doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? It's a part of the broader social, economic, political climate of the United States, and we are seeing inequities in our industry. It's only a reflection of what's going on in the United States more broadly. Generational wealth is a massive barrier for people who are thinking about entrepreneurship and what is, you know, a capital intensive industry, right? And it takes a fair amount of outlay to get up and started in the industry.
To get started in craft beer, Benny and Tio organized and sponsored craft beer events, specifically for black and brown communities to create safe spaces and a sense of belonging. They used their personalities to create their brand from the beginning. They sold t-shirts that said, "Black people love beer," and built a social media following on Instagram even before they had their first craft beer to sell.
For us, we've always just led with the culture aspect of it. And we knew in creating these spaces where people could feel themselves and see themselves in a curated experience, we knew that the community would start to form itself. And that's kind of exactly what happened. People started coming to our events and people started engaging with us on social and conversations.
The events evolved into Crowns and Hops products, which Benny and Teo produced with support from Scottish craft beer giant BrewDog and partnerships with local breweries, including Three Weavers Brewing Company here in Inglewood. They have five signature styles of beer sold in over 800 stores across California, Nevada, and Oregon, with limited drops in Atlanta and New York. Their next big dream is a brick-and-mortar pub called Crowns and Hops in Inglewood, hopefully in close proximity to the SoFi Stadium.
One of the things that was important to us specifically for choosing the city of Inglewood is we truly wanted to create something that felt and looked and sounded like the culture that's already here. One of the first things that you typically see in a gentrifying community is a white-owned brewery.
Part of the problem with a lot of the breweries that are open right now is I don't think they're purposely excluding Black and brown culture. Breweries are created and built around the culture of the owners. And if all the owners are white and none of the owners maybe listen to the same type of music or engage in the same sort of upbringing and understanding of life, then it's only going to reflect what they know. Our brewery is going to reflect what me and Tia knew.
What they know are barbecues, old school music, hip hop, and jazz. When it comes to their brewery, they've pinned down its personality. It's pretty specific.
If the brewery were a person, I think everyone in their family, especially Black folks, have like that aunt who is like super young and super hip, traveled everywhere, always had the new music, always had the dope car, the one who was always exposing the entire family to something new. Some people thought she was a little crazy. Some people thought she was super cool. Like, our brewery would be her.
They told KCRW that they want to create essentially a Crowns and Hops compound, a brewery, but also a place to learn how beer is made, and eventually a hub for creating videos, selling merch, and presenting art and music. They plan to have the brewery up and running in time for next year's Super Bowl at the SoFi Stadium.
It is a good business strategy to have a business in the region where one of the newest stadiums on the planet is there that will not only have the Super Bowl, but will also have the Olympics and the World Cup within the same decade. What we're doing is we're planning accordingly to ensure that as a Black-owned business, that we are as successful as we possibly can be.
Crowns and Hops want other new Black-owned craft beer companies to be successful too. Even though they're raising money for their own venture, last year they awarded grants totaling $100,000 to five young Black-owned beer brands across the country. Dr. J, the beer business expert, thinks the market will grow.
Black craft beer or Black-owned craft beer brands, the vast majority of them are young, less than 3 years old. And so presuming that that trend continues, then I would expect that we'll see more.
In fact, the South Los Angeles Beverage Company released its first beer label just last September, with plans to invest proceeds back into the South Central LA neighborhood where the founders work. The label is called The People's Republic of South Central. For KCRW, I'm Hawa Otori.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
From craft beer now to another fizzy drink. Normally, at this time of year, a group called Kombucha Brewers International hosts KombuchaCon in Long Beach, which is, you guessed it, a trade show for one of the fastest-growing drink crazes. And the guy that's driven the growth more than anyone else is the so-called Kombucha King, GT Dave, founder of GT Kombucha. Head to the drink aisle at your favorite grocery store, even at a gas station or a Rippy Mart, and chances are you're going to see his product. So how did his business and this drink take off? Well, GT joins me right now to talk about it. Hey there.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
I feel like you can divide people into two groups. I mean, people who are obsessed with kombucha and people who don't have any idea with what kombucha is. For the people who have never heard of it, explain what kombucha is and what it does for you.
Absolutely, I'd be happy to. So kombucha is this fascinating fermented tea that originated as far back as 221 BC, found in Manchuria, which is a town in China. And it was reportedly consumed in a small village in Manchuria where virtually every single household had this fermented tea in their back kitchen. And it was, you know, definitely a tradition. And in addition to that, people who drank it reportedly lived way longer than most people who didn't drink it. And therefore, this understanding or perception of its health benefits is one of the reasons why kombucha migrated from household to household, town to town, and then eventually country to country, and then continent to continent. But because back then, especially in, you know, as late as 221 BC, there was no internet or any kind of information conduit for people to learn and research more about kombucha, it didn't really become incredibly popular, at least here in the Western world, until about the early 90s, which is when my family first encountered it and when we started to make it, drink it, and of course fell in love with it.
And this is all about, like, you know, when you eat yogurt, you see that they have active cultures in it, right? This is what's so-called good bacteria that go into your system, right, and attack the bad stuff.
Yeah, that's simply put. I mean, essentially, as we know, there's bacteria everywhere, good and bad. And our body, at least when we start off in a healthy state, is virtually 100% good bacteria. But through stress, pesticides, an unclean diet, and other things that can compromise this good bacteria within our body, you start to have a little bit of a die-off. And unless we replenish those with more good bacteria, we sometimes run the risk of bad bacteria coming in and setting up residence.
What do you say to people who are like, this is just a fad, you know? I mean, this is, okay, it's yet another thing that people talk about that, you know, and people just jump on this bandwagon and, you know, it really doesn't do much for you.
You know, you're right. I mean, there is no shortage of snake oils out there. And that's certainly the resistance that I first encountered 2.5 decades ago when I bottled my first bottle of kombucha and sold it at Air One here in Los Angeles. But there's nothing incredibly radical about kombucha. The nutrients that it contains, just like you referenced with yogurt, it has similarities to yogurt, which has probiotics. It has similarities to raw apple cider vinegar, which is known to be a health food staple within, you know, any health enthusiast lifestyle or diet. So you have those two things that basically say, hey, this is not my opinion, these are facts. And then the third thing, which candidly is the most powerful, is that for any hater of kombucha, or any doubter, all you have to do is consume half a bottle. And whether you like the taste or not, you'll feel a difference.
But you said after a half a bottle, it's going to make you feel better.
Yeah.
I mean, again, the cynic in me is like, come on, GT.
Well, you know, okay, so there you go. I'll accept your challenge. So what a lot of people say, even within that first proverbial bottle, is, wow, I had a headache and it went away. I had a stomach ache and it went away. I was constipated and that's gone. Or the reverse, not to get crass, I had diarrhea and that's gone. Or I was craving something like sweet, like I was, you know, wrestling with myself to go grab ice cream or cookies or even sweet soda. And as soon as I had the half a bottle, I no longer have that craving. So it's really interesting. I mean, it's kind of like even after your first workout that, like, you notice, like, wow, this is doing something for me, which to me is the opposite of snake oil, by the way.
Your mom was diagnosed with cancer when you were a teenager. I want to talk about what got you into this business. Was that part of it? Was you saw the health deteriorate on your mother and you were like, I want to do something to help people heal?
Yeah, it very much was the foundation of my early beginnings. I mean, it actually was slightly different from the way you articulated it, is that, you know, I was raised here in Los Angeles by two very spiritual and holistic parents who raised me a vegetarian and raised me on plant-based foods and subsequently plant-based medicines. And so there was a lot that was coming into the household when I was at a very young age of wheatgrass and tofu and chia seeds and fermenting this and fermenting that. So kombucha was one of these kind of quirky foods that my parents brought into the household in the early 90s. But it actually, just the long of the short, is that when my mother was first when they first discovered the cancer tumor in her right breast, which, by the way, was the size of a golf ball, so it was very large, and they had said that she had had it for 4 years due to its size and its growth trajectory, they said, we're going to run some more tests, but we're pretty confident, if not positive, that this has metastasized rapidly throughout your body, including to your bones. And so I remember when my mother came home from even that first doctor's visit, where they gave her this news and basically told her that they were proceeding with a bone marrow transplant, which basically, of course, is the kiss of death. And it wasn't until a couple weeks later where they called her back into the office and said, hey, we got the final test results in, and we brought you in because we actually have good news and we want to learn more. Like, your cancer has not spread. It hasn't metastasized to the lymph nodes or anything like that. We actually want to know, what have you been doing? Have you been doing anything out of the ordinary? Chinese herbs, Chinese medicines, what have you? And that's when my mom kind of responded. She's like, well, I'm a vegetarian. I exercise and I've been drinking this pungent tasting tea for the last 2 years, and it makes me feel great. And that was her words that then informed their next words, which is, well, Mrs. Dave, whatever you're doing, keep it up, because your condition is miraculous. And that's all my parents needed to hear. And from that point forward, they put kombucha out of the category of this bizarre tea that they thought might be healthy for them to all of a sudden this legitimate health and wellness elixir, if you will, that not only helped keep my mom's body resilient, but also, which is also what I witnessed, kept her strong throughout her chemotherapy treatments, which, as we know, that's a lot of times what can actually kill the cancer patient before the cancer gets to them.
Most people who develop a business like yours, and it has expanded rapidly since you developed it back in the 90s, you know, they sell it at a point. They're like, all right, this has done really well. This is a, you know, it's made hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, you know, worldwide, things like that. You haven't sold it. You've kept it for a long time. Why keep doing it? Why not move on to the next thing?
Well, that's a great question. You know, to put it simply, I knew enough back then, like I know now, that unfortunately in the CPG manufacturing world, that once something that's as special as kombucha becomes popular, there's almost a perfect chance that the company, big food companies, will get a hold of it and completely bastardize it and take away everything that makes it special and just make it a glorified soda. And that's what is something that I refuse to allow to happen. Number one. Number two is my name is on the label. And that's not a vanity gesture. That really is saying that it's almost like when someone signs a letter to you, this is my endorsement that this product was made with, you know, love and care and good intentions. And this is my personal offering to you. And I don't really think that that statement would be valid if I had just sold my company to Coke or Pepsi and watch them completely wreck everything that I've built to and protected. And so therefore, that's why I have no plans to sell. And candidly, I don't think I'll ever sell.
GT Dave, founder of GT Living Foods, a billion-dollar kombucha brand. I want to thank you, GT, for coming on and talking to us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. As almost everything reels from the pandemic, one thing that may have slipped your mind, parking tickets. They are back after a hiatus, including in Fullerton in Orange County. The return of parking tickets has made finding reliable and safe parking for folks who live in their cars, vans, or RVs even more challenging. Well, now some advocates are pushing for the creation of a safe parking program countywide. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is here to tell us more about that push for KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So how did Fullerton and other OC cities handle parking laws at the beginning of the pandemic? I mean, was it like what was going on here in LA and other places, more leniency?
Oh, yeah, or rather, like, no enforcement at all. I know in Santana, where my wife has a store, there was no enforcement of parking, especially for street sweepers, for months. And then when it came to more permanent things, like, you know, for homeless or whatnot, for in Fullerton especially, they gave them that, like, almost like a amnesty period for a couple of months. But eventually, once we slowly started getting back into whatever normal is going to be, that's when they started enforcing these, especially overnight parking laws again.
Well, let's talk about the folks who live in their cars or RVs on the street. The safe parking program that Fullerton had, but apparently funding ran out for it earlier this year, right?
Yeah, so, there's been places across Orange County forever where people would park overnight, but specifically in Fullerton, you have the three Catholic churches there, St. Mary, St. Philip Annese, and St. Julia Falconeri. They got together with the city, and the city sponsored this parking lot, and that's what the city would pay for was, you know, restrooms, hand washing stations, and all night security. And so it worked pretty well until the, you know, January of this past year, at the very beginning of the year, when the funding just ran out. The city said, we can't do this anymore because we need to spend our money on other things. And we already have, you know, a budget that's kind of hurting.
Not to mention critics who lamented the restrictions of the safe parking program, right? I mean, your vehicle was searched. If you lived in your car or RV, you couldn't have a record. I mean, what was the point of those things? I mean, to keep the number of participants down?
Yeah, on one hand, I understand you want as little fuss as possible, as few problems as possible. But there's also these assumptions, like, come on, like, it's to me, it almost sounds like prison. Like, okay, you gotta, you know, open up your bunk, tear out your mattress, let me see what's in there, whatnot. And also what the city enforced was it has to be people from Fullerton. They didn't want to become a magnet for people all across Orange County showing up there. So what ends up happening is you're spending all this money to help out very few people. I think at the end, because part of what Fullerton also wanted was, okay, you could sleep here for a couple nights, but let's try to get you into transitional housing. I think at the end they helped out 17 people and they only got 3 people into housing. That's a failure at the end.
You mentioned the churches who came together and said, all right, we can do something about this. Religious leaders have been advocating for unhoused residents to be able to park in church parking lots. I mean, is there support, Gustavo, for that to happen all over the county?
Oh, you would think so. This is a capital, of course, of American Christianity. Humongous mega churches, Calvary Chapel, the various Calvary Chapels, Mariners Church, Saddleback Church. Nope, leave it to 3 small little Catholic churches. St. Mary's I'm more familiar with because that's the Mexican church in Fullerton. But the other two, they're also not exactly the richest of churches. I'm not going to presume to know why other churches across Orange County are not doing it. And let's not also forget the Catholic work in Santana, which has been housing, unhoused women for decades.
What does the county currently do to help people who are living in their cars or RVs? You said that it's been, you called it a failure. That's your word, because only a handful of people really got into some sort of permanent housing. I mean, how would you characterize what the county has done so far?
They're doing nothing. I mean, it's interesting because they told my colleague, Ben Brazil, with the Daily Pilot, which is part of the LA Times, they said, yeah, we think this is a great program, but we're not going to do anything unless a city does it. So in other words, they're saying, yeah, we'll help, but other people have to step up, which at this point, the county has a lot of parking lots. Look at the Orange County Fairgrounds, for crying out loud. If they really wanted to do something, they could do something very substantial there, although the fair is coming very, very soon. But still, the county, as has usually happened with homelessness in Orange County, the County of Orange government has done as little as possible, yet tries to make itself out to be a grand champion of helping out the homeless. It's not.
So it sounds like everything's, you know, sort of in a chaotic mode right now, and that there's no consensus on anything. I mean, will we see some sort of safe parking program in Orange County?
If it happens, it's going to come from these churches using their own funds or nonprofits. It's not going to come from city or county governments because, again, this is Orange County. Homelessness is not supposed to exist here. And as the priest that run those churches told my colleague, look, maybe I get it. Residents do not want homeless at their communities or around their houses. But if you kick them out, they're just going to go elsewhere. You're not solving the problem. At least with safe parking, it's a start to try to figure out how to solve homelessness. But if Orange County can't acknowledge it, then the problem's never going to leave.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times with our KCRW Orange County line today. Gustavo, as always, thank you.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, away beneath the Salton Sea, there could be another California rush. It's not gold, It's a brine. A brine full of valuable element. That's tomorrow. A reminder for you. We hope we have some value for you today. I hope you'll join my online chat with Mark Cuban, one of the hosts of ABC's Shark Tank. He owns the Dallas Mavericks of the NBA, one of the wealthiest people in the U.S. Entrepreneurship, venture capital in an age of social media. A little basketball, maybe some politics sprinkled in too. On the agenda, it's on Zoom this afternoon, just a couple of hours from now, 4 o'clock Pacific time. You can still RSVP at kcrw.com/events. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Michael Stark, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordahl were essential for our show this evening. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm Steve Chitakis. Have a great night.